Whether you want to tell a good old-fashioned story with a beginning, middle, and an end, or a crazy, ambitious postmodernist epic, the point is to engage the heart and mind of the reader and keep her turning the pages. And perhaps the most daunting part of creating a plot or a structure is knowing how and where to begin. In my next lecture, I'll talk about some strategies for getting started, using examples from William Faulkner, Mark Twain, and Marilynne Robinson.
Lecture 13. In the beginning, how to start a plot.
Getting a plot started is a scary prospect for many writers, but the reason it's scary varies from writer to writer. Some of us know so much about the story and characters even before we start that we can't decide where to begin. On the other hand, some of us only have a single episode or a single character, and we're not sure how to spin them into a complete narrative. In the first case, it can be hard to pick the right moment out of all the stuff in the story. And in the second case, it's hard to begin if you have no idea where the story is going to end up. Let's see if we can make this less scary. In The Art of Fiction, John Gardner says that a writer works out a plot in one of three ways: by borrowing some traditional plot or an action from real life, the method of the Greek tragedians, Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, and many other writers, ancient and modern, by working his way back from the story's climax, or by groping his way forward from an initial situation. Let's take these one at a time. First, I want to make clear that borrowing a plot is not the same thing as plagiarism, though there have been instances when writers, even very famous ones, have copied ideas so slavishly that they came right up to the edge of, and sometimes over, what we call plagiarism today. Plagiarism generally involves passing off someone else's work as your own. Usually the plagiarist copies the original word for word, or very close to word for word. The kind of borrowing that Gardner is talking about is different. For one thing, it isn't disguised. If a writer bases a story or a novel on a Greek legend, for example, he or she is usually upfront about it. The proof is in the story itself for all to see. For another, most writers who borrow a plot usually change it in significant ways, or use it for a purpose that the original author may not have intended or even foreseen. For example, many writers have retold Homer's Odyssey. The most famous retelling is James Joyce's Ulysses, which uses the Odyssey as a road map for the comings and goings of two men in Dublin on one day in 1904. More recently, the Coen brothers used the story of the Odyssey to tell the comic story of three men who escaped from a southern chain gang during the Great Depression in their film, O Brother, Where Art Thou? In each case, the writers took Homer's story and did something new with it, or at least set it in a completely different context. But the debt that these two works owe to the original is clear. Nobody accuses Joyce or the Coen brothers of ripping off Homer. Many writers have done something similar with other great works of literature, telling a well-known or beloved story from a different point of view. Many of these works show us the original in a new light. John Gardner himself retold the story of Beowulf from the point of view of the monster in his novel, Grendel. And a number of writers in recent years have reimagined famous stories through the lens of feminism. The American novelist Jane Smiley set Shakespeare's King Lear on an Iowa farm in her novel, A Thousand Acres, suggesting that the reason two of Lear's three daughters reject him so badly is that he had sexually abused them when they were girls. In Wide Sargasso Sea, Jean Rhys imagines the backstory of Jane Eyre from the point of view of the first Mrs. Rochester, the famous mad woman in the attic. And Valerie Martin's novel, Mary Riley, retells Robert Louis Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the point of view of a poor Irish servant who works in Dr. Jekyll's household. Other writers have had fun by putting a famous story in a new context. In his very clever novel, Fangland, the novelist John Marks, who used to work as a producer at 60 Minutes, moves the story of Dracula from the late 19th century and sets it backstage at a TV news magazine in the present day. In each of these examples, the starting point for the writer is determined by the source material. John Marx begins Fangland, for example, with a young American journalist, recently engaged to be married, who is on her way to interview a mysterious Romanian businessman. This reproduces the opening of Dracula, in which a recently engaged English lawyer travels to visit a mysterious Transylvanian nobleman. Then, of course, there are historical novels that are based on the lives of famous people or on events in history. In these narratives, the story, if not the plot, is already laid out for the writer. And as with novels that adapt earlier works of literature, the most interesting historical novels reimagine the history in interesting ways. Robert Graves' novel I, Claudius, and Marguerite Yourcenar's The Memoirs of Hadrian each tell the story of a famous Roman emperor from the emperor's point of view, giving us access to the private lives behind public events. John Banville's Dr. Copernicus is a fictionalized biography of the famous Polish astronomer. It tells the story of Copernicus in chronological order from his early childhood to his death, while giving us something only a novel can provide, namely access to Copernicus's most intimate thoughts. Other novelists have shown us famous people from the point of view of the less famous people around them. In his novel Quarantine, the British novelist Jim Crace reimagines Christ's 40 days in the wilderness from the points of view of several other people who were living in the Judean desert at the time. Sometimes, writers borrow types of plots rather than specific stories. Any beginning writer of mysteries or romance novels probably has a template for that sort of story in her head, whether she likes it or not. And while such a template can be a straitjacket, it can also be a convenient way to at least get a plot started, even if you plan to change it up later on. And sometimes writers borrow a plot not because they're particularly interested in the plot per se, but because they need a structure for what they are interested in. The science fiction writer William Gibson decided to structure his famous first novel, Neuromancer, as an old-fashioned noir thriller in the style of Dashiell Hammett or Raymond Chandler. What he really wanted to do, however, was evoke a complex and colorful future and play with the cultural, social, and political implications of the computer revolution. So he used a thriller plot to provide a framework, then he attached to it the stuff that really interested him. I did a similar thing with my first published novel, The Wild Colonial Boy. I wanted to write about political violence in Northern Ireland, so I modeled the book after the literary thrillers of writers I admired, including Joseph Conrad, Robert Stone, and John le Carré. And the last of the three novellas in my second book, Publish and Perish, is based explicitly on a famous and public domain horror story by the English writer M.R. James, Casting the Runes. James's story is one of the best horror stories ever written, and my version follows his plot pretty closely. But my version also plays what I hope are some interesting variations on the original, by changing the gender of the protagonist, setting it in Texas in the present day, and telling a lot more jokes than the original did. Gardner's next suggestion for getting a plot going is to start with the ending and structure the rest of the story so that it leads to that particular climax. Obviously, this method requires that you know how the story ends before you start writing. It probably works best if you're writing what I called a binary plot a couple of lectures ago. I'll be talking in much more detail about binary endings in the next lecture, but for now, suffice it to say that a binary narrative is one that has a yes or no or an either-or conclusion. The detective catches the murderer or he doesn't, the two lovers get together or they don't, or the main character experiences some sort of clear-cut victory or defeat. With a binary narrative, figuring out how to start by working backwards from the ending should be relatively easy. If there's a crime to be solved, you want to start with the crime or its immediate aftermath. If the climax requires the two lovers getting together, you need to start with their meeting or the situation that leads to their meeting. The rest of it is just working out the details. This is the method where you're most likely to find that an outline is useful. If you already know what happens at the end, That means you know what the plot needs to do to reach that point. You'll know which characters you'll need, what the setting will be, and roughly what steps the characters have to take to get there. I'm not much of a cook, but I imagine that working backwards from the ending is sort of like a chef tasting a dish and then reverse engineering the recipe to get that taste again. Of course, there are outlines and there are outlines. In my very first lecture, I suggested that a writer might sketch out a story by using the 5 W's of journalism and making a list of the various story elements. Who's in it, when it's set, where it's set, what happens, and why things happen. Making such a list in itself doesn't necessarily constitute an outline. It doesn't really tell you how to structure all these elements, but it certainly helps by cutting through the clutter and helping you focus on what's important. But sometimes a more formal outline can be very helpful. I've only used an outline myself once for my novel The Lecturer's Tale. This was the longest and most ambitious book I'd ever attempted up to that point in my career. It's a big, sprawling satire about an English department, with lots of characters who interact with each other in complicated ways. I didn't start with an outline, but about halfway through, I began to feel overwhelmed by everything I had to keep straight. So I took a few days off from actually writing the book and made a giant wall chart. This chart had all the major characters down one axis and all the chapters in the book along the other, and I graphed the movement of each character through the narrative. At first, making the chart was mostly an excuse not to work. I spent way too much time driving all over Austin, Texas, looking for just the right sketch pad and just the right set of colored markers. And then, after putting the chart up on the wall of my office, I quickly found it even more oppressive than trying to keep all the characters straight in my head, so I took it down. But in retrospect, the actual creation of the thing was enormously useful to me, and I'm not sure I ever would have made it to the end of the novel without it. On the other hand, I have more often written things using Gardner's third method of plotting, that is, starting with an image or a character or a situation and groping my way forward. You often hear writers talking about making a start without knowing where they're going. William Faulkner famously talked about how he started his great novel, The Sound and the Fury, with only a single image of a little girl with muddy underpants sitting in a tree, peering through a window at a funeral. If he was telling the truth, and nobody ever mythologized the life and career of William Faulkner the way William Faulkner did, then the fact that he started this way is especially impressive. From that simple beginning, The Sound and the Fury ended up as one of the most structurally complex novels in American literature. In fact, the novel may be complex because of this method, not in spite of it. The book has 4 major sections, told from various points of view. Each section is focused on a single day with flashbacks and flash forwards. According to Faulkner, this structure was the direct result of trial and error. Here's what he had to say about it. I tried first to tell the story with one brother, and that wasn't enough. That was section 1. I tried it with another brother, and that wasn't enough. That was section 2. I tried the third brother because Caddy was still, to me, too beautiful and too moving to reduce her to telling what was going on, that it would be more passionate to see her through somebody else's eyes, I thought. And that failed, and I tried myself, the fourth section, to tell what happened, and I still failed. Of course, Faulkner's claim that he failed is more than a little disingenuous. What he calls failure turns out to be an incredibly productive way of constructing a complex novel. But it's important to point out that this method is certainly more time-consuming and, along the way, probably more frustrating than constructing an outline and sticking to it. One thing you learn pretty quickly as a writer is that writing fiction is not an efficient process, and that's as it should be. As the example of The Sound and the Fury shows us, most of the time you discover the good stuff by accident along the way. The methods of structuring a plot are not limited to simply 3, of course, as I'm sure even John Gardner would have admitted. You can certainly combine the 3 methods in interesting ways. Even if you're borrowing a plot, you may find yourself monkeying with it. And even if you're trying to stick to the facts of a famous life, such as the life of Hadrian or Copernicus, It's what you discover as you imagine yourself into that person's head that makes the narrative come alive. And it's certainly possible to know how a story ends and still grope your way forward from the beginning, which is how I wrote my novel Next. I knew 4 things about the story when I started: how it ended, where it was set, the fact that it took place in one day, and roughly who my main character was. Apart from that, I knew nothing about what happened between the opening scene and the climax of the book. And yet, even though I knew what the ending was, I still wrote the book as if I didn't. This effort was helped by the fact that the entire narrative is told from the point of view of Kevin, my main character, who, of course, has no idea either what's going to happen to him on that particular day. Much of the book is just Kevin walking around Austin, Texas, in the heat of a summer's morning as he kills time before a job interview. As he walks, he takes stock of his life and remembers scenes from his past in flashback. I honestly had no idea what Kevin's history would turn out to be before I started, and I had only a rough idea of where he was going to walk. But I did have 2 advantages. I had a basic chronological structure to work with, a single day in Kevin's life, and I had the advantage that I was writing a book set in the town where I live. Each day, I simply rolled out of bed and walked the bit of Austin where Kevin was going to walk. I took note of everything and everyone I saw, and much of what I saw ended up in the novel. What surprised me as I wrote the book, however, was how much those sights and sounds in Kevin's present-day experience provoked ideas for Kevin's previous history. I never would have gotten these ideas if I just sat at my desk and tried to outline his backstory. For example, one of the biggest and most complex scenes in the book takes place in a chain supermarket called Gaia Market, which is my off-kilter version of Whole Foods. In this scene, Kevin stands in Gaia and witnesses a lover's argument. And as he listens to the young couple arguing, he remembers the time that he and his new girlfriend ran into his ex-girlfriend in the Gaia Market in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he lives. The juxtaposition of a present-day scene with a flashback in a similar setting ended up working really well. In fact, it became one of the key scenes in the book. And it didn't come from an outline. Instead, it was the direct result of me wandering into Whole Foods one morning. The main lesson here is that no matter how you decide to structure your plot, whether you outline it in every detail ahead of time, or you just wing it, or you split the difference and do a little of both, you should be prepared to take advantage of happy accidents. Now, if you're still daunted by taking that first step, here are some ideas that may make it easier. First, remember that many stories begin in medias res, which is Latin for in the middle of things. In fact, it's tempting to say that all stories begin in medias res, because there's really no such thing as a story that begins ex nihilo, or from nothing. Even if you start a novel with the birth of the main character, the way Dickens starts David Copperfield, that character already has parents and relations, a family history, and a social and historical context. Or consider the opening line of Genesis, which is probably the least in medias res opening in history. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Even here, there is already a character in place, namely, God. What in medias res usually refers to, however, is starting the plot at a point where the story is already underway. Homer's Iliad starts in medias res. By the time the Iliad opens, the siege of Troy has already been going on for 10 years, and the present time narrative of the Iliad only depicts a few weeks near the end of the siege. Even though the story makes reference to how the war began and how it ends, the Iliad does not dramatize the kidnapping of Helen, which started the war, nor does it dramatize the fall of Troy, which ended it. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, the ghost of Hamlet's father appears in the first scene and tells Hamlet that he was murdered. This means the play has the same structure as a classic murder mystery, where half the story has already taken place by the time the body is found. More recent examples of in medias res include nearly every James Bond film, the opening scene of which usually shows 007 already fighting for his life. Another striking example is the opening scene of the television series Breaking Bad, which shows high school teacher turned meth cook Walter White, wearing only his underpants and a gas mask, driving an RV frantically through the desert. This scene happens to be a flash forward. The rest of the episode backs up to show how his recent diagnosis of lung cancer has led him to cooking meth. When we consider the technique of in medias res, we see that choosing where to start a narrative is not necessarily about finding the chronological beginning of the story. Instead, it's about deciding what the most dramatically productive moment is. In other words, what's the beginning moment out of which you can get the most mileage as a storyteller? Shakespeare could have started Hamlet with the funeral of Hamlet's father, or with the marriage of Hamlet's mother to his uncle Polonius. Instead, he chose to open it with the moment that was most likely to make Hamlet reconsider recent events, namely the appearance of his father's vengeful ghost. And the opening of Breaking Bad hooks viewers immediately, making us want to know why this pudgy middle-aged guy is running around in the desert in his tighty-whities waving a gun. The opening of Breaking Bad does what an opening is supposed to do. It strongly suggests what the story is about, in this case middle-class, middle-aged desperation, but it does not explain everything. Yet another way to approach the start of a plot is to limit your choices. As I've said before, real life flows ceaselessly and infinitely in all directions. It's knowing what to leave out that turns life into fiction. You could limit your time frame, for example, have the story or novel take place in a single day, or a single week, or a single month. You could also limit the point of view, tell the story from the point of view of only one character. And if that doesn't work, the way it didn't work for Faulkner when he was writing The Sound and the Fury, you could introduce other points of view. You could use leapfrogging narrators, the way Faulkner does in one of his other novels, As I Lay Dying, or the way George R. R. Martin does in his Song of Ice and Fire series. But limiting the time frame doesn't necessarily mean you have to completely leave out other times in the characters' lives. This brings us back to in medias res. You can start the narrative at a particular moment and limit it to a particular time, the way Virginia Woolf limits Mrs. Dalloway to the events of one day. And yet, you could still range backwards and forwards in time and place, the way Mrs. Dalloway incorporates flashback scenes that take place years earlier in completely different settings. But what about that first line, that very first step? Here you have a lot of choices, too, each one of which will both dictate and be dictated by what comes later. If you were telling a story from the point of view of a character who dies at the end, for example, you're going to be limited to a third-person narration, unless you want that character to narrate the story from beyond the grave, the way William Holden's character narrates the film Sunset Boulevard, or the way the murdered girl in Alice Siebold's The Lovely Bones narrates the story of her own death. If you're writing a story that features a surprise later on, one that the main character never sees coming, you might want to start in the first terse-person present tense, or in the close third-person. Using these points of view means that the reader lives in the moment right alongside the main character, seeing no more than she sees and knowing no more than she knows. As a result, the result is that the reader is just as surprised as the character is when the moment of surprise finally comes. Perhaps the best thing to do is to take a look at the openings of books and stories you admire. Take into account not just the immediate effect of that moment, but also how that opening prepares the reader for what comes later on. There are as many ways of doing this as there are writers, of course, but we can still group them into some useful categories. There are too many different ways to open a story for me to talk about them all, but here are some examples. One category, of course, is simply beginning at the beginning, the way Tolkien does in The Hobbit. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. This is a very fairy tale way to begin, of course. Even if Tolkien doesn't actually say it, there's an unspoken once upon a time at the beginning of that sentence. But as brief and to the point as it is, that simple 10-word sentence tells us right away that we're in a fantasy world inhabited by creatures called hobbits. It also tells us something important about hobbits, namely that they live underground, which, if you know Tolkien, you'll have to admit turns out to be surprisingly important. Large sections of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings take place underground. Another way to begin at the beginning is simply to state the premise of the story as bluntly as possible. Consider the first line of Franz Kafka's story, The Metamorphosis. One morning, upon awakening from agitated dreams, Gregor Samsa found himself in his bed transformed into a monstrous vermin. And by vermin, Kafka means a cockroach. In this particular translation, the opening sentence is only 19 words. But at the end of it, we know the name of the main character, we know that he is a man riddled with anxiety, and we know that he has undergone a horrific transformation. The rest of the story is essentially just working out all the implications of what it means for a man to be transformed overnight into a giant cockroach. Both of these openings are in the third person. But what if we begin at the beginning in the first person, with the narrator directly addressing the reader? I don't want to say that this is a uniquely American way of opening a novel. This is how David Copperfield begins, after all, as well as Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. But certainly many of the most famous American novels begin with the narrator speaking directly to the reader. Herman Melville's Moby Dick begins with, "Call me Ishmael." And Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn begins with these famous sentences. "You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. That book was made by Mr. Mark Twain, and he told the truth mainly. There was things which he stretched, but mainly he told the truth." In this case, the opening is not particularly dramatic, but it draws us in with one of the most distinctive voices in American literature, direct, humorous, and folksy. The opening of Huckleberry Finn also sets the tone of the novel. Whatever happens later, whether it's funny or desperate and profound, we know that we will hear about it from a character who is simultaneously lively and humane. The opening of another great American novel, Marilynne Robinson's Housekeeping, combines the directness of Melville with a straightforward summary of the important characters and the premise of the plot. "My name is Ruth. I grew up with my younger sister, Lucille, under the care of my grandmother, Mrs. Sylvia Foster, and when she died, of her sisters-in-law, Mrs. Lily and Nona Foster, and when they fled, of her daughter, Mrs. Sylvia Fisher." The deceptive simplicity of this draws the reader in, but there is a lot packed in this sentence. Orphan sisters, the death of a grandparent, abandonment. It also sets up the reader for the slow-motion surprise of the rest of the novel as Ruth and Lucille's final guardian, Sylvia, turns out to be one of the most eccentric characters in modern American fiction. Everything in that first sentence is true, but the working out of that situation, two little girls being cared for by a series of older relatives who either die, flee, or turn out to be strange, leads the reader into one of the most mysterious and complex experiences I've ever had as a reader. And it's the straightforward directness of Ruth's voice, her willingness to tell us everything, that keeps us engaged with the novel, no matter how weird and unsettling things get. As I keep saying in these lectures, writing is about imposing order on chaos, about making decisions. These decisions are often arbitrary ones, out of what seem to be an infinity of choices. Writing fiction is also as much about what you leave out as what you leave in. Your decision about when, where, and with whom to begin a narrative opens one path for you, even as it closes off a lot of others. And just like making decisions in real life, sometimes you don't realize what the consequences of your choices are until much, much later. But, unlike life, you can always go back and fix a bad decision, or even start over from scratch. Writing, and especially plotting, is not a science. It's an organic and wildly inefficient process of trial and error. But it's the stuff you don't plan for, the stuff that you don't see coming, the stuff that just presents itself, surprise, as you go along. That's the stuff that makes fiction worth reading and makes the writing of it simultaneously frustrating and rewarding. In the next and final lecture about plot, I'll talk about bringing a narrative to a conclusion, and I'll be focusing on three examples: Henry James's novella, The Aspern Papers, Flannery O'Connor's short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, and Catherine Mansfield's story, Miss Brill. In the meantime, here's an exercise to help you jumpstart the opening of a story. Imagine, at random and without thinking about it too much, some sort of striking or intriguing situation. For example, imagine a man and woman who are eating at a candlelit table in a romantic restaurant, but they aren't speaking to each other. In fact, they don't even look at each other. Or imagine a woman standing in an alley in the rain at night, holding a knife. Then again, without thinking about it too much, try imagining the very next thing that happens, and then the next, and then the next. If you find yourself running out of steam or boxing yourself into a corner, then go back to the original situation and try something completely different. I think you'll be surprised at how productive this can be.
Lecture 14. Happily Ever After. How to End a Plot.
Starting a narrative is daunting. Bringing one to an end can be tricky. You just can't win. The end of a plot is the last thing a reader sees, and what she thinks of the ending often irreversibly colors her opinion of the entire narrative. A plot that has a successful, or at least a vivid and memorable ending, can make a mediocre narrative seem better than it is, while a weak or unconvincing ending can make an otherwise superb narrative lose its luster. Our old friend E.M. Forster thought that wobbly endings were a common problem for novels in particular. He had this to say about it in Aspects of the Novel. Nearly all novels are feeble at the end. This is because the plot requires to be wound up. Why is this necessary? Why is there not a convention which allows a novelist to stop as soon as he feels muddled or bored? Alas, he has to round things off, and usually the characters go dead while he is at work, and our final impression of them is through deadness. Incidents and people that occurred at first for their own sake now have to contribute to the denouement. In the end, even the author feels he is being a little foolish. Most novels do fail here. There is this disastrous standstill while logic takes over the command from flesh and blood. I suspect this is a bit tongue-in-cheek. Given that Aspects of the Novel is essentially a celebration of careful craftsmanship, I doubt that Forster is entirely serious when he wishes that novelists could just stop as soon as they get muddled or bored. And remember that Forster was notoriously ambivalent about plot. Remember how he said in a droopy, regretful voice that, yes, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. But even so, Forster is expressing a peevishness that all writers feel at one time or another. He's also right that it's not uncommon for novels, even great ones, to fall apart at the end. The last quarter of Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is notoriously weak, especially after Tom Sawyer turns up in the story. The comedy turns labored, the narrative loses momentum, and the plot is resolved in a series of unconvincing contrivances. You can tell that Twain got, well, muddled and bored and just wanted to wrap things up. One of my favorite books, Joseph Conrad's Nostromo, has the most brilliant opening third of any novel I've ever read. The last third of it is much more melodramatic and conventional than the rest of the book. It's almost as if Conrad got tired or lost his nerve toward the end. There are some other factors at play that make endings difficult to talk about. For one thing, what people consider a good ending is dependent on individual taste. For example, many readers are disappointed if a romance doesn't end with the couple getting together, while others think a conventional happy ending is sentimental and unrealistic. For another thing, what writers and readers consider a good ending has changed over time. The endings of many great 19th century novels now strike many modern readers as contrived and unconvincing. Charles Dickens is indisputably a great writer, but some of his novels have endings that seem ludicrously sentimental to a modern reader. The good characters find love, security, and happiness, while the bad characters are either humiliated or killed off. Or, in the case of Fagin in Oliver Twist, they are humiliated and killed off. Some classic novels seem unconvincing to a modern reader because our cultural, social, and moral assumptions have changed. Women who have sex outside of marriage are no longer expected to kill themselves the way they do in several famous 19th century novels. And some famous 19th century endings have been so widely imitated that they've become hackneyed. At the end of Jane Eyre, a poor but intelligent and virtuous woman wins the love of a brooding, sexually magnetic rich guy. However original this may have been when Charlotte Bronte was alive, now it's a trope in modern romance novels and a cliché of Hollywood romantic comedies. But even if they disagree about the particulars, nearly everyone agrees on the two fundamental qualities that a good ending should have. Namely, it should be both believable and satisfying. Believability and satisfaction are not the same, however, and they are not interchangeable. It's possible for an ending to be believable without being satisfying. In real life, for example, killers often get away with murder, or two lovers who seem perfect for each other never actually get together. Neither of these outcomes would be very satisfying in a conventional narrative. However, on the other hand, it's not possible for an ending to be both satisfying but not believable. If the killer is caught, or the lovers are brought together as a result of a blatant contrivance on the part of the author, the ending is unsatisfying because we don't believe it. And it should go without saying that a satisfying ending is not necessarily a happy one. Some of the greatest literary novels ever written have unhappy endings. And in recent decades, a lot of first-rate genre fiction has come to rely on unhappy but dramatically satisfying endings. George R. R. Martin's A Game of Thrones, the first novel in his Song of Ice and Fire series, ends with the death of the novel's noblest character. So what do we mean when we say that an ending is believable? In part, believability depends on what we as readers bring to a story. Our own individual understanding of how the world works and what real people are like helps determine what we will believe in a work of fiction. This doesn't mean the rules of the real world can't be bent. Readers are willing to accept that the laws of nature can be altered, broken, or ignored in fantasy, horror, and science fiction, as long as you provide an alternate set of rules for your fictional world and stick to them. Readers of any genre, however, are less likely to believe a character whose final actions violate their understanding of human psychology. Different readers have different expectations of how human beings think and behave, or how human beings ought to think or behave. An ending that strikes one reader as completely plausible and even admirable will strike another reader as preposterous and even offensive. Take the ending of Jane Eyre again. Mr. Rochester may be brooding and sexually magnetic, but he persuades Jane to fall in love with him without bothering to tell her that he's already married and that he's keeping his crazy first wife locked in his attic. And yet, at the end of the novel, after a series of twists that include a surprise inheritance for Jane and a house fire that conveniently kills the first Mrs. Rochester, Jane Eyre happily marries Mr. Rochester. Most readers accept this ending. For one thing, we take into account the narrative conventions of the time the novel was written. For another, we want Jane to be happy because she is such an admirable character. Still, it's possible to imagine a reader who just can't believe that someone as smart and independent as Jane would give someone as manipulative and self-serving as Mr. Rochester a second chance. Our willingness to believe the ending of Jane Eyre depends partly on our general understanding of human nature, but it also depends on our understanding of Jane Eyre herself as an individual character. If character is more fundamental to fiction than plot, as I argued in Lecture 3, then the key to crafting a believable ending is staying true to the nature of your characters. You can make an ending believable if you can get the reader to play along with the premise of your narrative, and if you play fair with the reader by obeying your own rules. But respecting your own characters is especially important. But, as I said a moment ago, just because an ending is believable doesn't make it satisfying. In the terminology of my long-dormant bachelor's degree in philosophy, believability is a necessary condition of a satisfying ending, but not a sufficient one. And as we've just seen, believability isn't an absolute quality. Reasonable people can disagree over whether an ending is credible or not. But satisfaction is an even more ineffable and unquantifiable quality, one that is even more dependent on taste and personal experience. You can at least make a case that a particular ending is believable. You can argue that it's prepared for, that the writer played by the rules, and so on. But you cannot convince a skeptic that an ending is satisfying, any more than you can make someone change his mind about a food he doesn't like. If you don't like onions, no amount of argument is going to make you like onions. Consider the passionate arguments that erupt online or around water coolers after the final episodes of such popular television series as The Sopranos or Breaking Bad. If you were annoyed and unsatisfied at the abrupt disappearance of Tony Soprano in the very last moments of his final episode, no amount of passionate exegesis from me is going to change your mind. Just as it is with onions, satisfaction is a wholly subjective judgment. Endings are a matter of taste, and as the Latin maxim has it, de gustibus non est disputandum. In matters of taste, there can be no dispute. At this point, perhaps we should throw up our hands like E.M. Forster, but as even he would admit, yes, oh dear yes, a work of fiction must have an ending. So let's just accept the fact that an ending cannot be all things to all people, and let's take a look at three endings that are considered satisfying by most readers. In The Art of Fiction, our other old friend, John Gardner, says that there are two ways a narrative can end. In resolution, when no further event can take place, the murderer has been caught and hanged, the diamond has been found and restored to its owner, the elusive lady has been captured and married, or in logical exhaustion, our recognition that we've reached the stage of infinite repetition. More events might follow, perhaps from now till kingdom come, but they will all express the same thing. Now, this is an oversimplification, because there are other types of endings, not to mention hybrid varieties, but these two definitions probably cover most possibilities. Let's start with the sort of ending Gardner calls resolution, but which I have called a binary ending. As you may recall, this is the kind of ending that resolves an either-or situation or answers a simple question that was posed in the opening pages of the narrative. This is the sort of ending you find in most best-selling novels, popular movies, and television shows. Who committed the crime? Will the two star-crossed lovers get together? Will the intelligence agent foil the supervillain's plot? Will the hero of the epic fantasy complete his quest? Plots with binary endings are often dismissed as mechanical and contrived, and to be honest, many of them are. You could even argue that the endings of some of these simple binary narratives is the least important thing about them, and the real reason we enjoy them is that we enjoy the setting or the characters. For example, I used to watch reruns of the television drama Law and Order obsessively. Even when I knew I'd seen an episode once or twice already, I'd watch it again anyway, because I could never remember how it turned out. I came to realize that my pleasure in watching the show didn't come from the ending, but from the time I spent in the company of characters like Sam McCoy or Lenny Briscoe. This is often the case with well-written genre narratives. The journey is interesting, even if the destination turns out to be unmemorable. But let's not dismiss binary endings out of hand. There are a lot of great narratives where the ending is both immensely satisfying and unforgettable, and maybe even the high point of the story. John le Carré's great spy novel, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, is the story of a veteran British spy named George Smiley, who is asked by the British Intelligence Service to find a Soviet mole in their midst. This is a binary ending with a vengeance, along the lines of a classic country house mystery. Smiley assembles a list of suspects and investigates each one. Then, in a sweaty-palmed climactic scene, he discovers which one of his colleagues actually is a Soviet spy. Much of the fun of the book lies in the twists and turns of the investigation and in Le Carré's sharp delineation of his large cast of characters. But the ending is tremendously satisfying and not mechanical or contrived at all. This is because Le Carré complicates the ending by making the mole an upper-class Englishman and a former lover of Smiley's wife. This means that the mole is not just a traitor to his country, but a traitor to his class and to his professional colleagues. It's a binary ending with layers, because the mole's betrayal is at once political, social, and personal. Many literary novels also have binary endings. Will Elizabeth Bennet marry Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice? Will Ahab catch and kill Moby Dick? Will Jay Gatsby win Daisy Buchanan back from her brutish husband in The Great Gatsby? One literary story in particular has perhaps the most satisfying binary ending I've ever read. Henry James's novella, The Aspern Papers, is narrated by an unnamed literary critic whose passion is a long-dead American poet named Jeffrey Aspern. The critic has learned that some letters from Aspern may still be in the possession of the poet's former lover, who is now a very old woman living in Venice. The critic then goes to Venice, where he learns that the old woman, Giuliana Bordereau, is living in a decaying old palazzo in the company of her plain, middle-aged niece, Miss Tina. Because Giuliana and Miss Tina are living in poverty, the critic insinuates himself into their house by renting a room from them. And because he suspects that Giuliana has no intention of letting anyone see the letters, he tries to allay her suspicions by pretending to be romantically interested in Miss Tina. This is a tight little triangle of characters. The unscrupulous narrator, the suspicious old woman in possession of a priceless literary treasure, and the lonely middle-aged woman. And it sets up not one, not two, but three binary questions. Will the critic get the letters? Will Giuliana discover his true intentions? Will the critic callously break Miss Tina's heart? James shows us the wary dance of these three characters through a series of impeccably crafted scenes, each one of which ratchets the tension up a little higher. The novella culminates in an almost gothic climax in the middle of the night, when the narrator tries to break into the desk where he thinks the letters might be hidden and is caught in the act by Giuliana. She curses him, and he flees the house. Giuliana dies soon thereafter, and the narrator returns to the house to ask Miss Tina if she might let him have the papers. Miss Tina hints that she might, if he agrees to marry her. The narrator flees again, because he can't imagine marrying someone he thinks of as a ridiculous, pathetic, provincial old woman. It goes without saying that the narrator of the Aspern papers is no prince. But he's desperate for the papers. So in the final pages of the novella, when the narrator returns once more to the palazzo, where Miss Tina has changed somehow, as he puts it, her look of forgiveness, of absolution, made her angelic. It beautified her. She was younger. She was not a ridiculous old woman. This trick of her expression, this magic of her spirit, transfigured her. And while I still noted it, I heard a whisper somewhere in the depths of my conscience, why not? After all, why not? It seemed to me I could pay the price. In other words, at the end of the story, the critic is tempted to marry Miss Tina in order to get the letters. Then, on the very last page of the novella, Henry James springs the trap he has expertly laid for both the narrator and the reader, when Miss Tina reveals that she burned the letters one by one the night before. And so the Aspern Papers fulfills the reader's expectations by answering all three of the binary questions it posed at the start. No, the critic does not get the papers. Yes, Giuliana discovers his true intentions. As for the third question, will Miss Tina's heart be broken? The answer turns out to be the most satisfying twist in the story, because Miss Tina turns out to be as skillful and ruthless a player as the narrator. If the narrator did break her heart, Miss Tina earns her revenge by breaking his, by denying him the one thing he ever really wanted. This is storytelling of the highest order. Henry James not only imagines a binary situation that generates suspense, he peoples the plot with three vivid and sharply defined characters and stays true to them. There is the conniving narrator who isn't nearly as clever as he thinks he is. There is the mistrustful old woman who has spent a lifetime living in the shadow of a famous poet. And there is the watchful spinster who shines with beauty in her one moment of bitter triumph. The reversal at the end is the best kind of surprise, where the reader is thinking simultaneously, I did not see that coming, and of course. Now let's talk about the sort of ending that Gardner calls a case of logical exhaustion. This is the point at which a narrative has reached its deepest understanding of a character or a situation, and beyond which it would just be repeating itself. This sort of ending does not rely on raising a binary expectation in the reader, but it does require the early pages to draw the reader into the narrative by setting up an expectation in the reader that some sort of revelation is going to occur. A variety of this kind of ending is the epiphany, which I explained a couple of lectures ago. The example I used then was James Joyce's long story, The Dead. But this time, I want to talk about the short story Miss Brill by Catherine Mansfield, one of Joyce's contemporaries. It's only 5 pages long, and like many epiphany stories, it doesn't really have a plot. but like the best of the Epiphany stories, it is carefully constructed to deliver a devastating emotional blow at the end. Miss Brill is a late middle-aged English woman who lives alone in a rented room in a seaside town in France, where she makes her living teaching English. Every Sunday, she sits on a bench in the public gardens, listening to a brass band and watching the crowd pass by. She especially enjoys eavesdropping on the conversations of the other people who sometimes share her bench. In the opening paragraph, Miss Brill is seated on the bench on a bright but slightly chilly Sunday afternoon. She is wearing a fox stole, the sort of fur wrap that still has the head, feet, and tail of the fox at either end, and she recalls the pleasure she took in lifting it out of its box and brushing it before she put it on and left her room. The middle section of the story is like Georges Seurat's brilliantly detailed pointillist painting, A Sunday on La Grande Jatte. As Miss Brill observes the old married couple on the bench next to her, watches children play, and witnesses an old woman trying unsuccessfully to flirt with an elderly man. She takes delight in thinking of the scene as a kind of play in which she's one of the actors. She even enters into a lovely fantasy in which everyone in the park starts to sing along with the band. The young ones, the laughing ones who were moving together, they would begin, and the men's voices, very resolute and brave, would join them. And then she too, and the others on the benches, they would come in with a kind of accompaniment, something low that scarcely rose or fell, something so beautiful, moving. And Miss Brill's eyes filled with tears, and she looked smiling at all the other members of the company. Yes, we understand, she thought. But what they understood, she didn't know. This moment when Miss Brill feels a communion with all the other people in the park is immediately ruined, however. An amorous young couple sit on the bench next to her, and the girl refuses to kiss the boy because of that stupid old thing at the end of the bench. It takes a moment for the reader and Miss Brill to realize that the stupid old thing she's referring to is Miss Brill herself. The girl goes on to make fun of Miss Brill's beloved fox stole by comparing it to a dead fish. Then the story jumps abruptly to its last two paragraphs, where Miss Brill returns to her tiny, shabby room and sits on the bed for a long time. The story ends like this. The box that the fur came out of was on the bed. She unclasped the necklet quickly. Quickly, without looking, laid it inside. But when she put the lid on, she thought she heard something crying. I'm not sure my summary can evoke the story's power, but I hope it gives you at least an idea of the elements that make it work. Every sharply observed detail and every slight shift of emotion builds toward a single piercing epiphany. Mansfield starts by introducing a woman whose most elegant possession is an old fox stole, which she treats with loving care because it reminds her of her youth. Then, in the middle section, in the manner of Mrs. Dalloway, Mansfield shows us the park through Miss Brill's eyes and allows us to participate in Miss Brill's reactions. We see how she prides herself on her gift of quiet observation, and we share the slight superiority she feels towards the people she observes so sharply. Then we share her moment of communion. She is one of the people in the park, after all, one of the players in this play they all put on each Sunday. She takes brief respite from her loneliness by indulging in the fantasy of everyone singing together, only to have her illusions shattered by two thoughtless young lovers. And just as the end of the aspirin papers clicks shut like a trap on the last page, so does the last paragraph of Miss Brill. The title character suddenly and unexpectedly sees herself as the world sees her. And from that slight observational remove that she was so proud of in the park, she can hear herself weeping. There is no binary plot here, no situation to resolve. But we have reached the point that Gardner called logical exhaustion. Miss Brill has had a devastating insight into her own life, and the reader has shared that devastating insight. This insight changes everything that Miss Brill and the reader had thought up to this point, and it cannot be taken back. Her life will go on, but there is nothing new left to learn. The story moves sentence by sentence with ruthless efficiency to an ending that's every bit as precision engineered and every bit as powerful as the end of the aspirin papers. Let's look now at a sort of hybrid ending, existing halfway between the binary ending and the epiphany. Flannery O'Connor's story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, is about a Southern family who take a drive to Florida and end up being murdered on a lonely country road by a serial killer. The killer, who is called the Misfit, is mentioned in the story's very first paragraph. The grandmother of the family, who is the story's main point of view character, reads aloud from the newspaper about his recent escape from prison. After that, the Misfit is mentioned only once more, briefly, before he and his henchmen turn up later in the story, after the family has driven its car into a ditch. Meanwhile, the central portion of the story is a comic portrayal of the family bickering with each other in the car and stopping for barbecue. The reappearance of the Misfit might have been a Dickensian coincidence in the hands of a lesser writer, but his appearance in the newspaper in the first paragraph is played for laughs. As a result, when he reappears at the end, full of genuine menace, the reader's experience mirrors that of the family as they slowly realize they're about to die. This can't be happening, you think the first time you read the story, which is exactly what the family must be thinking. But because it is so skillfully prepared for, the ending leads you to a radical change of perspective. Instead of finding the coincidence unbelievable, you find instead that the ending alters your understanding of everything that came before. The grandmother's foolishness, for example, which was funny and kind of sweet for most of the story, ends up becoming tragic and pitiable. The offhand references to the Misfit in the first paragraph and briefly again in the middle of the story turn out to be foreshadowing. They are hints, if only we'd picked up on them, of a version of the world that is both profound and terrifying. The story closes with the same finality as the Aspirin Papers. O'Connor prepares for her ending with as much skill as Henry James does. But where Henry James lays his plot points out where the reader can see them, O'Connor hides hers behind a scrim of irony. The Misfit is foreshadowed in the first paragraph, but in such a way that a first-time reader doesn't suspect he's important. He's just the groundless fear of an old woman. And O'Connor also skillfully underplays the plot twists that lead to the family's death. It is the grandmother's insistence that they take a side trip to visit a house she used to know that leads to their accident. And what seals the family's doom is the fact that she calls the Misfit by his nickname as soon as she sees him. These two mistakes by the grandmother are simultaneously shrewdly observed bits of her character and tripwires that lead inevitably to her death and to the deaths of her loved ones. The ending of A Good Man is Hard to Find falls halfway between a binary ending and an epiphany. On the one hand, it ends definitively, with the murder of several of its characters. But like an epiphany story, it radically changes everything the reader thought about what came before. It doesn't answer a question that was openly posed at the beginning of the story, but instead, it answers a question that the reader didn't even realize was being posed until after he finishes the story. The question is the world a safe place? And the story answers with a definitive no. What makes these three endings satisfying? I can't say for certain, because not every reader will necessarily find them as satisfying as I do. But I can tell you what they have in common. Each one is prepared for, starting with the first page or even the first paragraph of the narrative. The opening of the Aspirin Papers sets up all three binary questions that the ending answers. The Misfit is mentioned in the very first paragraph of A Good Man is Hard to Find. And Miss Brill's faded fox stole, the symbol of her own faded appeal, is mentioned in the very first paragraph. Think back to John Gardner's definitions of how a narrative can end, that a story either resolves or it logically exhausts itself. All three of these endings essentially leave the reader with nothing left to know. Each writer has taken us as far as we can go. All the major questions are answered, and we have gained our deepest understanding of the situation or the characters. In the last lecture, I talked about two ways of starting a plot. One is to work toward an ending you already know. The other is to let the plot tell you what the ending should be. All three of these endings are more or less airtight and perfectly prepared for. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Henry James, Catherine Mansfield, and Flannery O'Connor knew the ending of each story before they started. They may very well have. I don't actually know. But it seems to me that either method may generate a satisfying ending. At first glance, it might seem that knowing the ending in advance is the easiest way to write, because you can direct the story at every point to head in that direction. But you also run the risk of forcing the characters in a particular direction whether they want to go there or not. In that case, your plot can seem contrived and unlifelike, and your characters seem more like